Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very happy to be spending this Saturday afternoon detention with the worst kid in school, JB.
Hey, hey, hup, 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 hup. Don't you forget about... Okay.
Very nice. Very nice. We're going to be talking about The Breakfast Club. And, of course, this is a podcast that serves two functions. One, if you're not in the Chicago area, you get to hear us talk about The Breakfast Club for an hour. And two, if you are in the Chicagoland area, hopefully you came out yesterday when this podcast comes out to see me host a screening of the movie and a Q&A. And now you get to go home and listen to the podcast and hear me repeat the things that I talked about at the screening.
And that was yesterday night, and it went really well.
Thank you.
I was amazed at how well it was attended and how, for the first time, because I go to most of those screenings, at the very end, after the discussion, people were actually throwing paper money at Patrick.
That's kind of nice. I like paper money, like bills or like pretend money?
No, it was real money.
Okay.
It was, I felt like I was in Magic Mike XXL.
We did this when I hosted a screening of Blazing Saddles the week of that screening. We did a podcast on the movie so that those who attended the screening can go home and extend their enjoyment of the experience. And those of you who weren't there can still hear us talk about a movie. So we're going to be talking about The Breakfast Club later on. But of course, I will start the show the way that I always do, with a heartfelt apology. Just kidding. Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
We're sorry for the last podcast. Obviously, I've been seeing the summer blockbusters and trying to avoid certain summer blockbusters that I got a heads up on. But... lately, I was driving here this afternoon, and it occurred to me that I may have just gotten my wish in that for decades I've been screaming that multiplexes with 10 screens, 20 screens, 30 screens should devote one screen to maybe something different. And you and I have both noticed that at the theater that we frequent most regularly, there are these odd films of late that didn't quite get a release or have a limited release.
A lot of times it's the stuff that shows up on VOD.
Yes.
And somehow there's a contractual obligation, has to show on this many screens, and our theater, for whatever reason, is one of those screens.
Yeah. But the Charlize Theron...
Okay, Dark Places.
Right.
Yes.
That looks interesting,
yeah.
And I might go see that tomorrow because I'm certainly not going to see the Fantastic Four, and I like going to the movies, but... maybe a notch above those contractual releases. So far this year, I've been to several films that I would classify as Patrick wouldn't go see this in a million years.
Okay.
It seems geared for an older crowd, although certainly not shamelessly pandering to an older crowd like the second best exotic Richard Gere vehicle. But I'm here thinking of a film I saw last week called Mr. Holmes.
Yes.
With Ian McKellen. And Laura Linney, and it's about Sherlock Holmes, and it was directed by Bill Condon, who did Gods and Monsters, also with Ian McKellen, and it's very good.
That's what I hear.
It's not great. I'm not sure if it's aspiring to greatness, but it was a good time. It was better than I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
A lot better than I thought it was going to be. And I've had similar experiences this year with the Carey Mulligan version of Far From the Madding Crowd, which was wonderfully entertaining for what it was. And not getting much advertising. And then earlier, The Woman in Gold, which I enjoyed way out of proportion to what I thought that was going to be. And then, of course, The Water Diviner, which I believe you said you would never see.
I don't still say I would never see it. I think without your recommendation, I was never going to see it.
All of these films have their pleasures. There's certainly a better time at the movies than the latest hyped blockbuster that doesn't live up to its reputation. So as long as there's a Mr. Holmes or Far From the Madding Crowd at the theater to sort of counterbalance Fantastic Four or something like that, I feel like I've gotten my wish and
yeah.
I should be happier.
And I can't say for sure that it's been happening more this summer. Again, maybe it's just a function of the fact that more of these movies are showing up at the theater near us. But it does at least feel like every week there's some sort of counter-programming.
And we have the Chicago Film Critics screening that's once a month.
Right.
And then you add that to the once a month TCM screening. And then Cinemark by our house does a series that's usually 4 or 5 weeks, and then they take a week off.
Marcus is now doing one as well.
This week coming up, it's Grease with the lyrics on the screen.
Oh, boy.
But I'm just saying that
there are alternatives.
I got my wish.
Right.
And then yesterday at Flashback Weekend, which was 2 tens of fun.
That's right.
Seeing our good friend Heather Wixon.
That's right.
I sat through Mad Monster Party, and yesterday we were talking that the best metaphor for Mad Monster Party is White Castle hamburgers, that when you sit down with them, it's, this is going to be good. And as Patrick said, 10 minutes in the Mad Monster Party, oh boy.
It becomes kind of tedious.
Man, talk about wasted potential. But Sven Gulli, the horror film host from MeTV, was there and sort of recreating an episode of his show with some pre-tape segments and playing games with the children in the audience. I mean, clearly that's the main reason I went.
Like head games?
No. There was a sort of a version of Pictionary that he played, the Bozo Circus Grand Prize game. There were a couple things that he did. Oh, a version of Family Feud.
Okay.
Where all the questions were about monster movies.
I like it.
He didn't just show up. They had put some thought into it. His camera crew were there, so maybe in an episode down the road you'll see highlights of this. But that's what I've seen lately.
It kind of made me wish that was more of a feature of, like, do that Saturday night instead of the outdoor screening of Halloween, a movie most of us have seen.
Or, as long as you have the guests there and they're introducing it, and like you said, I literally can't count the number of times I've seen Halloween, maybe because I used to show in class. Why not turn the soundtrack down a little bit, give four of them a microphone in the back of the place, and have them do a live audio commentary?
What we call value added.
And I had told Patrick before that for years and years and years, I went to Wonderfest, and there's a horror film host from down south called Dr. Gangrene, who's charming and delightful. And a highlight of Wonderfest is that on Saturday night, he basically does an episode of his show live where you see the movie, but you get to see all the bumpers too, and it's fantastically fun.
Yeah. I'll just talk about two movies very briefly because I haven't seen a ton in the last week, maybe because I was at Flashback for a large part of it. I watched a documentary that I recorded off of cable called I Am Adam West. And it is just kind of this fan documentary, probably funded through Kickstarter or something, that's literally just a love letter to Adam West. Illuminates nothing about what makes him different or special. Tells me very little about his life, except that he went through some kind of hard partying years post-Batman. And now he's embraced as sort of an ironic celebrity. He's sort of in that same George Takei category.
Sort of a third-tier William Shatner.
Right. It's like you're just eccentric enough to be amusing to us, and we're pleased with ourselves for loving you. It just was worthless as a movie. And I have nothing against Adam West, but we were having conversations, you, me, and Adam Riske, around the Chicago Critics Film Festival, because they showed a handful of documentaries. And you always have to ask yourself, is this a good documentary or is the subject interesting? Like, we saw the documentary Raiders, which is about a couple of childhood friends who spent years remaking shot for shot Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that was interesting. And it was like, oh, what a neat idea for a documentary to focus on. But the documentary itself was not that good.
Right. And I know Heath, about a year ago, and I experienced this new wave of fan documentaries that, first of all, the filmmaker, and I use that term loosely, thinks it's easy to make a documentary.
Yes.
It's not. Well, you get all the stuff and you do this and then you cut it together. But the real reason these people are making the film is to spend time with the people who were involved. This is their way of being in. So we saw several uncompleted documentaries.
Which is astounding to me.
That was a supercharged version of asking for an autograph and paying them $20, that these people were clever enough to say, well, we bring a camera crew, and then I get to talk to them for a half an hour. But that doesn't make it a documentary. Also, I Am Adam West. Was that actually included in the recent Batman Blu-ray crazy box?
I don't know. I didn't buy the... I want to buy it, but it's so expensive.
I have it.
Yeah.
I haven't opened it yet. There's a button on the side of the box that plays the theme.
No buttons, no funny packaging.
They gave you a little car, a little metal Batmobile.
No.
And some playing cards, and it's nonsense because, again, it doesn't match everything else. But here's what I remember. It's either on there, but if I remember correctly, the filmmakers really lobbied to have it on there, and the producers of the Batman box set said, no way. It's one of those two.
Okay.
It's either on there.
Or isn't, or in spectacular fashion.
It's either what I'm saying or the opposite is what I'm saying.
It was not a good documentary. And then the other movie I watched, I actually revisited, for the purposes of writing a piece that now I'm not going to write, so I'll talk about it. The Roger Corman produced Fantastic Four from 1994.
And where did you manage to see that?
Itself now, I believe, the subject of its own documentary. Because now every movie that didn't get made also gets a documentary.
It's fodder.
We get Dune, and we get Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, and we get Superman Lives, and we get
Terry Gilliam, Man of La Mancha.
Which was a really good documentary.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. So now the Fantastic Four, and you know, it's an interesting story. Does it need its own documentary? Probably not. So I had this theory in the back of my head after seeing the new Fantastic Four and really not liking it, that the Roger Corman produced one was still the best Fantastic Four movie. And so I was going to write this article about here's why it's the best. And I wasn't trying to be a troll or whatever, or just provoke people just to be a dick. I really did think that I thought that, and I rewatched it, and it's probably not the best of the Fantastic Four movies, even though I think there are things in it that it gets right that none of the other movies do. And it's a crazy story. If you're not familiar with it, it was like the option that they had on the property was expiring. And so it was a race, not just to finish the movie, but literally to start it up, write it, cast it, shoot it, and get it out before a certain date. And
the costumes speak to how quickly it was done.
Yeah. I mean, the effects are rough. The Thing looks a lot, they seem to use the same technology as they used to do the Ninja Turtles from those movies, which felt state of the art in 1990, but for some reason in 1994 suddenly felt cheap. And so there's a lot of stupid stuff, but there's actually a lot of things that I really think it gets right. I can't make the case that it's the best Fantastic Four movie, but I don't think it's nearly as bad as a lot of other people do. And maybe it just speaks to, it has a certain spirit about it that is what I associate with the Fantastic Four, and not what we are getting now, which is people's heads exploding.
Yeah, I don't want to open the can of worms, but there are comic book characters who are dark,
yeah,
and then there are some who are not. And I would argue that Superman is not a dark character in that the Christopher Reeve version may have captured what that should be. And I've said this ad nauseum. Again, I'll keep this real short. Really, the only comic book I read as a kid is the Fantastic Four. I love the Fantastic Four. Start your psychoanalyzing. And no movie has ever gotten it right. And I say this hoping to be proved wrong. I'm thinking it's the one comic book, I've told you this before, I don't think it can be done. For a number of reasons, it's unfilmable.
Maybe.
I would like to be proved wrong.
Yeah.
But as I discovered from reading reviews, going dark on the Fantastic Four is a mistake. You had said the other night at another movie that doing it as a period piece the early 60s,
yes,
kind of like Mad Men with this guy made out of rocks, that might work.
Again, once upon a time, I believe right after Spider-Man hit, and all of a sudden it was, well, let's make every comic book into a movie. Peyton Reed was attached to direct the Fantastic Four, and he had just come off of Down with Love. And to me, that was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
He has comedy chops. He had done the period thing so well that I could immediately see, same way when somebody said Edgar Wright is doing Ant-Man, it's like, oh, I immediately know what that movie is, and I'm in. And oddly enough, Peyton Reed ended up doing Ant-Man, and Josh Trank did, actually Tim Story did that version of Fantastic Four. I might agree with you. A few people have pointed out, including one of our listeners, James Garcia, has said before on Twitter that the best movie version of the Fantastic Four is still The Incredibles. And I wonder, I mean, it gets the family dynamic right. Yeah. It gets the different powers.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe part of it is the stretchy thing. I know most people point to The Thing. Well, right. You can't do The Thing. And I will say that Josh Trank's movie, in terms of the look of The Thing, except for having him walk around naked, you know, because it would be ridiculous to put him in, like, shorts. Why would he wear shorts? He looks good, you know. They kind of cracked that, because that was one of the problems with the Corman one and with the Tim Story one, is that a guy in a suit, it just doesn't look right. He doesn't have the size, whatever. A lot of people think, well, you can't do The Thing. Okay, so they figured out a way to do The Thing. I think part of it is, in a live-action film, the stretching looks just goofy. We can't accept it, whereas in animation, we have no problem accepting it.
I really like that point about The Incredibles. And again, I'd like to be proved wrong. I don't understand why any filmmaker working on a comic book movie would ever be scared of period again, because the first Captain America movie worked tremendously well in a period other than being contemporary.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if we're ever going to get another Fantastic Four movie or not. This one really kind of crashed and burned. So now it becomes, does Fox continue to exercise their option just to get back at Marvel? Do they let the rights go back to Marvel? Does Marvel do anything with it? Or does everyone just think that this property is, like, toxic? I don't know. We'll see. But let's talk about The Breakfast Club.
Hey, fourth time's a charm. As I'm watching it last night, it occurred to me, call me Mr. Numbers.
All right.
That Breakfast Club is released in 1985. In 1985, I am 6 years out of high school.
Okay.
And you are 6 years away from going to high school.
Interesting.
So,
it's right in the sweet spot.
I'm guessing you didn't see it when you were eight.
No.
And I was very surprised last night, because I think I may not have seen this movie since 85.
Okay.
I was very surprised it was rated R. I didn't remember that.
Okay.
And as the film goes on, you quickly realize why it's rated R. The lesbian scene between Molly Ringwald and Ally Sheedy has copious nudity. And actually, some shots I thought would warrant an NC... Okay, I'm joking. They swear... And I would argue this film comes pretty close to portraying the way teenagers really swear.
Yes and no.
And something I thought was sort of wonderful. Because let's start here. I'm very ambivalent about this film.
Okay.
A lot of people love it.
Yeah. It's
really love it.
It's a movie for me that I can no longer divorce myself from. I grew up watching it so many times that now I see it and it's like, I don't know if this is good or bad. All I can do is recite it. Do you know what I mean? Like
that I'm regarding it like a cathedral in Europe. Right. And that I really can't be objective about it, although...
And I'm regarding it like singing Happy Birthday. It's just like, I know it so well that it's just what it is.
We just go along with it. Coupled with that is the fact that the film comes out in 1985, and in 1985, I begin teaching.
All right. So you're on the bad side.
I am on the bad side, and I think it's not a surprise that watching it again last night, two of my favorite scenes involve the teacher.
Okay.
Which we'll talk about in a second, but I gave the film a lot of credit for showing the students getting high.
Okay.
Because young people get high. They do. That's the age where they're sort of experimenting with that.
Right.
And I also give Hughes a lot of credit, because I'm not the biggest fan of John Hughes, that there are no negative repercussions from it.
Sure.
And it sort of makes them more willing to talk to each other.
Right.
Although I still have a problem with the semi-obligatory dance medley.
Yes.
That scene, and I thought it was interesting, that scene, Dance Fever, comes right after what I think might be the best scene in the whole movie, the extended scene where they just talk.
Right.
And was this Hughes or the studio saying, well, they just talk for about 8.5 minutes. Could they dance next?
I mean, I know Hughes was pretty much calling the shots. I don't know how much studio interference he got, because he was...
Yeah, by
he
then.
He was hot, you know, when he made this movie, and very protective of this movie, especially. The dance number, I know, was originally just supposed to be Molly Ringwald. She was supposed to be the only one who danced, but she felt self-conscious about it. So he had everyone dance because he was very much about protecting Molly Ringwald in a weird way.
Yeah. Because what I always think about John Hughes is he got so famous and his films made so much money, specifically this and Home Alone, that I always thought it was interesting that he first came to prominence writing for the original National Lampoon, specifically these short stories that were really dark and really transgressive. In fact, Vacation is based on one of his first pieces for Lampoon called Vacation 58. And what happened was there was Vacation 58 and Christmas 59, and those are masterpieces. And then you sort of saw the rough edges off. Although I think if you go back and watch Vacation,
it's the exact same as his film career, oddly enough.
That there's still...
He had ideas right out of the gate, and then it was just sort of repeating
and sawing, sanding rather, yeah. The rough edges off, because both of the Lampoon pieces get really dark. And in Vacation, where they drag the dog, I think that's...
It's pretty dark.
But the entire short story is like that.
Okay.
I won't give it away. But that what he originally did to get noticed is sort of what he cheerfully abandons to get famous.
Okay.
Or maybe, you know, what do I know? I'm certainly not a writer and I'm not rich, but that he knew that he had to give that up for movies.
Maybe, although I've never seen his movie career as any kind of selling out. I mean, if anything, it seems like this is where his heart was, at least at this point. Maybe he just kind of outgrew that kind of storytelling, because I don't think you can argue that like he is not 100% heart and soul in this kind of stuff in the mid-80s, you know.
No, you're right there. As we watched The Breakfast Club last night, my wife commented that he sort of created his own genre.
Oh yeah,
that
100%.
This is a John Hughes film.
Yes,
but I have so much more affection for Breakfast Club and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles than a lot of the latter ones, where it really seems that he was just cranking it out or that the formula was getting watered down.
Definitely. And you know, and his name gets attached to so many movies that he didn't necessarily even direct. And so we all say Pretty in Pink or Some Kind of Wonderful. We say, well, those are John Hughes movies because he did write them and because they follow those beats. But he, you know, he didn't. He only directed a handful of movies, and only a few of them, I would say, are very good.
He did not direct Baby's Day Out.
He did not direct Baby's Day Out, but he did write it.
A student that you went to high school with is an extra in that movie.
Well, that's terrific.
Speaking
of which,
all
I have is this dumb podcast.
Once again, we're watching it last night, and I usually watch these things with my wife, and she pointed out that... one of my favorite things in the movie is John Kapalos as the janitor. I think he does a really good job with a part that's written oddly.
Okay.
But at the beginning, when we see all the shots inside the school, his picture is up on the wall,
right,
as student of the year.
Right.
So clearly a statement is being made. And then Jan pointed out that at the high school at which I teach, your picture is up on the wall. So it was like, ooh.
Better get that mop. That moment is one of, I think, the rare moments of real cynicism in The Breakfast Club, because so much of the movie is about, like, I want to listen to these teenagers. I side with these, even though I'm the adult, I side with the teenagers. And to suggest that all of their problems ultimately amount to... not nothing, but, you know, their hopes and dreams will be dashed and they will be mopping the floors of a school, is unusually cynical, I think, for the rest of the movie. I don't think there's anything else like that in the movie.
But I think what ameliorates that somewhat is I don't think that character has any problem being a janitor.
I don't either, and I'm not even saying that Hughes necessarily looks down on it, but that's a very conscious choice to say he was this and now he's this.
And that's pointed out because there's the scene where Bender says, Bender is sort of, how does one janitorial service?
That the janitor was originally played by Rick Moranis, and he went real broad with it. He was doing like a weird accent, and he was doing it real comic, and Hughes fired him and recast him with,
I did not know that.
John Capolos. Well, these are the kinds of things you found out at the recent screening of The Breakfast Club at the Elk Grove Theater in Elk Grove Village, Illinois.
I thought it was also clever that when we see Paul Gleason in his office, there are two things in the background, a rigid tools calendar with a partially clothed woman, and maybe it was a different time. But that seems really inappropriate to be on a teacher's office wall. But, of course, it's you saying that Gleason is a rigid tool. Also, a White Sox cap, so that's another reason to hate him. He's a White Sox fan. But, again, I was watching this last night so much like through the eyes of a teacher, because now I'm old. It occurred to me that the entire movie would be negated if Gleason just sat in the library.
Right.
Which is what he's supposed to be doing.
Right.
He's doing detention supervision.
Right.
So why does he want to be in his office?
I don't know. Because he's neglectful? Because he's derelict in his duties? Because, as you said, if he stayed in the library, there would be no movie.
There's no movie.
Which is true of...
He would know that Bender got out of the storage closet. I think Gleason is really good in this movie, and I think, like you said, the thing with the janitor sort of gives it an edge, because Gleason sort of specialized in playing
I can't think of many times he didn't
the guy who's
prick.
Wrong the
right.
SOB
right
that and again I'm just looking this at this through the eyes of a teacher. He's such a prick that the two scenes I always remembered are the scene where Bender's mouthing off to him, and he keeps giving Bender another Saturday detention.
Yeah.
And it even gets the kids to say, stop, because neither of them will back down. And as a teacher, I've had, I would say, interactions with kids that are like that, that eventually make you see that that's not the way to solve it, because everyone winds up losing. But the scene I really remember is in the storage closet,
yeah,
where Gleason just goes nutty and tells Bender his salary as if, you have to prove that you're an adult. But I actually work with teachers, no names, who get a lot of self-satisfaction out of proving that they're smarter than the kids.
Sure.
Of course you're smarter than the kids.
You're supposed
That's
to be.
That's why you were hired to right. be a teacher. I mean, that whole thing where he's listed as accomplished, he says, everyone loves me around here.
I'm a swell guy.
Is really... disturbing.
Sure.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
What do you think of Judd Nelson's performance?
Oh boy. I go back and forth on it. I think it works in the way that I think it provokes the other performances.
Yeah.
And that was it was that way on set. He was method in the movie. He auditioned in that costume as the character and went kind of method on set to the point where Hughes tried to have him fired. Hughes was big on firing people. I think especially because he was upsetting Molly Ringwald, that he was nearly fired off the movie, and then the cast had to step in and say, no, he's doing a good job. You got to keep him. I think sometimes he goes so big that it's cartoonish and ridiculous. But then in the scene in the storage closet, I think he's really good. The way he all of a sudden reveals himself to be this scared kid as soon as he's called out on his shit, and Vernon says, you know, go ahead, hit me. And he kind of recoils, and you realize, you know, he has a family life of abuse. And so I think he's so good in that scene. And I think those moments do shine through from time to time that I'm able to forgive how much he dominates the rest of the movie.
Because on the surface, I thought he's been given a part that's impossible to play.
Yeah.
And I really can't think of any actor from that time who would immediately spring to mind and would say, well, if it had been this person.
But it was going to be John Cusack, which I think is wrong. I think Cusack could have played the Anthony Michael Hall part, but he was close to being Bender, and then Judd Nelson got it.
Really?
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see what... Cusack would bring to Bender. But looking back, and again, I graduated high school 5 years before the film came out, I knew boys just like Bender, the slacker, underachiever, stoner, who yet had this amazing vocabulary and were actually really sharp.
Right.
I knew several guys like that. So I always gave Hughes credit for pinpointing that that's a very specific type. I've also always faulted the film because if each one is one of these stereotypes,
yes.
And I think I've shared this with you before, where's the theater kid?
Sure.
We don't get a theater kid.
Sure.
And if any stereotype has been with us, I mean, there are theater kids.
It certainly does not cover the spectrum, and you could almost argue that there's some crossover between Ali Sheedy and John Bender, even though they are very different kids. I think, you know, some people might just lump them all together as well. They're the outcasts, and they're outcasts for different reasons. So it's not like it gets everyone. And here's my, if I have a problem with The Breakfast Club, and I mean, I have problems with The Breakfast Club, whatever. I think John Hughes didn't just create a genre of movies. I think John Hughes helped shape the American teenager in the 1980s.
Yes.
I'm not actually comparing this movie to Rebel Without a Cause, but I think it's probably the most important movie about teenagers since Rebel Without a Cause.
That's the exact film that Jan and I were comparing it to last night.
Okay.
Because I was going at it from the standpoint of if Rebel Without a Cause is a Hollywood social problem film, and it is, and that's a very specific genre, in a weird way, Breakfast Club follows a lot of those tropes because whenever Hollywood makes a social problem film, Hollywood can never blame an institution. So in Rebel Without a Cause, it's not the creation of the suburbs which removes children from anything they might actually want to providently spend their time on, that literally there's nothing to do in right. the suburbs. In Rebel Without a Cause, it's very clear. It's the parents.
Yeah.
That each child has parents who are... And in Breakfast Club, the same is true, that the institution of the high school is never blamed for creating this stratification where people are put in little baskets. The problem with The Breakfast Club is Paul Gleason's a son of a bitch.
Sure. It's,
oh, and the parents and are the to parents, blame again.
Yeah, big time the parents. Although, I will give Hughes credit for having Ali Sheedy say, oh no, we're going to turn into our parents. It's inevitable. And I do think there's a little bit of blame kind of on the structure of the high school or the social structure of the high school during that scene where
Anthony Michael Hall says on Monday, would you
say hi to me? And they say no. You know, we would wait till you left and we would make fun of you. And again, I think that's a good scene. And I think that's interesting. So I think it's a really important movie about teenagers. I think the problem is what it asks you to do is put yourself in one of those five boxes and say all teenagers can fit under one of these categories. Yeah. And I know ultimately his point is to say, we have more things in common than we do differences. And even though it seems like we come from these two different worlds, we are sharing this one difficult experience called adolescence. At the same time, I do think it gets everyone to say, like, well, which member, you know, those stupid like Facebook quizzes or which right. member of the Breakfast Club are you? And that's kind of what it ends up doing. And so
and if that's the case back then, there was no me right. on the screen, and now it's Paul Gleason, and that makes me very angry because I don't want to be Paul Gleason.
I always was an Anthony Michael Hall, and I think in 85, or even when I was watching this movie all the time in kind of the late 80s, early 90s, that was probably not ideal, but I feel like we've come far enough in 2015 that now you're happy to be the Anthony Michael Hall.
Well, as John Bender says, you are every parent's wet dream. Watching it again last night, I was really impressed by Anthony Michael Hall's performance.
He's the best one in the movie.
And Ali Sheedy. And I think what they do is a little bit more subtle. And Sheedy is given some stuff that's a little harder. Whereas the showier roles,
yeah,
I'm not as impressed by. And here's an example of what I'm talking about with Anthony Michael Hall. And clearly some of this is direction and some of this is editing. But at the very beginning, he's thinking about moving to the seat next to him. And he gets halfway. And Gleason says, and you're not to move. and then he's stuck not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
And then he moves back. His timing on that is beautiful.
It's sometimes I get sad when I think about what he turned into, even by the late 80s, by the time he was on Saturday Night Live and making Johnny Be Good, or even one movie later, because Hughes had fallen so in love with him after Vacation and 16 Candles. He writes him this great part in this, and then continues to try to write parts for him, and so he puts him in Weird Science, and Weird Science is like a teenager with bad instincts just let off the leash, and so he's so kind of unfunny and manic in that movie.
And didn't play to his charm.
Right, and I'm just not a Weird Science fan at all. But he's so good in this movie, and he's subtle in a way that I've always appreciated, because you have at least three of the actors kind of shouting. Molly Ringwald doesn't shout that much, but
it's a showier part.
It is, and they play it showier. When Anthony Michael Hall's speech about the one time his cousin Kendall smoked weed and he was wearing other people's shoes and his mom doesn't want him wearing other people's shoes, and it was really weird.
And he had a taste for all these really unusual foods.
he started eating all these really weird foods.
The thing he does with the pen on his lip.
Yeah.
And especially, I think, the long dialogue scene that we were just talking about. I think it might be the longest scene in the film, where he's crying at one point, and then it's revealed what he did to get the detention, and the specter of teen suicide raises itself, and then it's revealed that it was a flare gun. And they start laughing, and the change,
right,
when he recognizes that it's funny, is really a nice subtle piece of work.
Yeah. He was still in high school when they made this movie.
Him
and Molly Ringwald were both actually still in high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
How old was Bender?
I want to say 24.
Yeah.
Molly Ringwald was 16. She was the youngest. I think Bender was like 24.
And that comes across, although I noticed Hughes tries not to put them in the same frame. I think it only happens twice. But Anthony Michael Hall is actually taller than the other two.
By the end of the movie.
Oh, because he was growing?
Yeah.
There's the scene where Emilio Estevez is again threatening to punch Bender, and Anthony Michael Hall sort of comes between them. And then the famous scene when they're dancing, where he's in the middle.
Right.
So as they were filming, he got taller.
That's the story. And they shot it basically in sequence, so I don't even know if that holds water.
And the film was shot at a real public high school that's pretty near to where we are right now.
Yeah.
A school district had expanded too fast, and the school was only open for maybe 8 years, and then they closed it, and it was this empty behemoth. A buddy of mine used to live like almost across the street from it. And then Hughes got the idea, well, if we use this, we just have free reign. But of course, he wasn't happy with the library, which was only one story. And so what you're seeing in the film is a set that they built in the gym.
That's right.
But all the hallways and everything, and I have to say, as a teacher, all the stuff of them roaming around the hallways is just so on.
Yeah.
You can tell that wasn't a set. Maybe they painted some stuff. But
yeah. Yeah, I think it's so... Again, I'm not the world's biggest 16 Candles fan either, and I wonder if I just don't think John Hughes is very funny, but I think Vacation's really funny, and he wrote that. And I thought when I saw Home Alone when I was like 11, that was the funniest movie I'd ever seen in my life. So some of his more outright comedies, I just don't laugh at that much, and 16 Candles has a lot of problems with racism and all that kind of stuff. But it does seem to be the thing that kind of put the bug in his ass about, like, I'm going to be the guy who really tries to listen to young people and be their voice. And Breakfast Club is that times 100.
But in that, it's certainly head and shoulders above other teen comedies.
Right.
Especially of the 80s, where... The characters are talking and saying things, and it's not just an Animal House ripoff,
right?
Transmuted to high school,
right?
Where it really becomes disturbing that kids so young are doing those things. By the way, I went on to an internet inflation calculator,
okay,
and found out that Paul Gleason's $31,000 salary, today would be $68,000.
Okay.
So make of that what you will.
Sure.
I looked it up. I want to include that on the podcast.
He's a swell guy. And I don't know what the response was, and maybe you remember this more, because for the longest time, I remember just, we would get the TV guide, and I would just go in the back where it listed all the movies, and it would have like two-sentence summaries. And for the longest time, I just saw this title, The Breakfast Club. I didn't even know it was about young people, because that those words don't conjure up anything. I don't know what that means. It wasn't until I was a little bit older that I finally found out what it is. But I don't know what the response was, because it does seem like the kind of movie where adults would see it and say, oh, this is like pandering melodrama. And teenagers would see it and say, oh, this guy gets me.
Yeah. I remember it being very popular.
Okay.
And very influential. Again, I was right out of college. I think it might have actually come out my last semester of college, like months before I started teaching, which made me the teacher I am. I said, I'm going to be just like Vernon over there. I had a question watching it last night. And again, this is 30-year-old memories. At the very end, spoiler alert, the last shot of Bender walking across the football field.
Yes.
And again, it's a little bit on the nose, but I love the attention to detail about how they all get dropped off in the morning.
Sure.
I think that works well,
sure.
At least as shorthand. So Bender's walking across the field, and he Simple Minds song comes up on the soundtrack, and he makes the gesture with his fist. I, for all the world, remember the film fading to black.
Okay.
And then the credits coming up?
The credits come up as he's...
Have they redone those for video?
No, I don't think so.
That was the way it was in the theater?
As far as I know. I never saw it until last night. I had never seen it in a theater.
Okay, and it just... there's a term for it. It's called burn-in, where they redo the credits for any number of reasons for TV.
Okay.
And it looks... like for some reason they wanted to retain that iconic image or something. I might be wrong. I'm getting old. but the film obviously retains its popularity. I went on the cable machine to see if it was available to watch on demand for free before I borrowed your Blu-ray. This is the one movie I've never purchased. And this is going to drop Wednesday?
Yes.
Thursday night, AMC is showing it.
Okay.
At 5 o'clock.
All right.
That's as far as
Comcast. With commercials.
Oh, my God, it'll be 3 hours. That's as far as Comcast could get me to. And for a second, I didn't see the date, so I was like, it's on right now?
this was a movie that, because it used to run on, you know, TBS or TNT
or
whatever, it ran all the time. And so I had a lot of the ADR swears memorized. I don't remember what most of them are now. I know you weren't allowed to say eat my shorts, which is amazing because a cartoon character made that expression very popular.
Because
so he said eat my socks in the TV edit that I saw in the mid-80s.
But it's also like that bit that they do on the Jimmy Kimmel Show where if you overdub eat my shorts, you're going to assume the original was worse.
Right, yeah, for sure. Let's talk about... let's talk about the ending for a little bit here, because I'm a fan of this movie. Like I said, I was a fan of it so much so as a kid and growing up as a teenager that now I have no objectivity when it comes to this movie. But I think I still like it for what it tries to do. I just think his heart is so in the right place, almost maybe to a fault, I think. But I've always felt very angry and betrayed by the ending of this movie.
I know what you mean.
Okay.
In fact, when we get to that part.
Okay.
Last night, I turned to my wife and I posit an opinion that I've had since I first saw it. And there was a very short pause and she said, duh, everyone thinks that. And I was like, you're kidding.
Is the opinion that when Ally Sheedy is in her, we'll call it basket case get up, that she's super hot?
Yes.
Of course. Of course.
And I...
And the betrayal, even if she wasn't super hot, the betrayal of that she... makeover flies in the face of what everything that this movie is supposed to be about.
But it's part of a larger betrayal that suddenly, why do we need two couples?
We don't.
And, well, Anthony Michael Hall winds up alone. not that I mean to remake this movie, but wouldn't it be better if we ended with Gleason looking at the essay? And I actually like how the essay is repeated at the beginning.
As do I.
I like that. And then have the five of them leaving the front of the building. Again, no makeover, no lovey-dovey.
Right.
And Bender turns to the other four and says, I'll see you guys on Monday.
Yeah.
And they say, yeah. And that's the end of the film.
Sure.
Just something a little bit, although to be fair, the idea that Molly Ringwald would date him to get her parents upset, I find very funny.
I do too. And I know there's a line to that effect. I've never seen them as like continuing on as a couple. To me, it always just seemed like her individual act of rebellion in that moment. So yeah. She can feel like a naughty girl, but that they weren't going to continue dating. And I'm fine with that. Like, that makes sense to me because I have the same reaction. Do we need to pair them off or whatever? I do kind of like that, even though Anthony Michael Hall doesn't hook up with one of the girls, A, he's never really shown that much interest in that kind of a thing, and B, that his reward, his sense of satisfaction is that he's so pleased with the essay that he's written. He's so proud of it. And I love that moment.
He pats himself on the shoulder after he reads it over.
Yeah.
And to be fair, something I noticed last night that I'd never noticed before is that Hughes is subtly trying to prepare us for this ending that we don't like. About three quarters of the way through, Emilio and Allie often share the frame.
Yeah.
And Emilio is looking at her.
Yeah.
Almost staring at her. And then Sheedy looks over and notices. That happens three times.
Okay.
And this is before the makeover. But okay. I've always took that to mean either his inclination or Hughes's direction that he's beginning to think about her perhaps in a romantic way. That he's,
sure.
He's considering what he thinks of her.
And I know that, you know, I think what Hughes is trying to say is that her arc is that she realizes she doesn't need to hide under that stuff, that she can sort of come out and just be a person, you know. But I hate the way that it's handled. And maybe this is me projecting onto her. I never felt like she was hiding because she was like scared of showing her real self. I just thought that was her real self.
Right. Which I would like more, because after the makeover, her whole character sort of disappears.
Right.
What we liked about her.
Right.
Also, I was guessing that this depends on an audience, and tomorrow night we'll find out.
Yeah.
So I will perk up my ears and I'll be extra. I'll try to really, really notice this. I remember seeing this in a movie theater, and I still remember the audience's reaction to her revelation of why she's there. I thought at the time was the single funniest joke in the movie.
Yeah.
After all this Sturm und Drang that we go through with
right.
the other ones,
right.
It was just great.
Yeah.
And really fits her character.
Yeah, definitely.
And actually explains a lot of her reactions and actions in the first three quarters of the movie, the way she responds to things.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly she's supposed to be the basket case and sort of very guarded and very hidden. But from a very early point, she's regarding what's going on around her in the library as entertainment.
Sure.
That she's very much the audience.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, I was more aware than ever before on this most recent rewatch of the structure of the film, so that by the time we get to, like, do you know why I'm here today? It's like, yeah, no, everybody slowly has to parse out the reveal of what they did to get there. I kind of like that a few of them, it's just immediately thrown away out front. Just, well, yeah, you pulled the fire alarm and Molly Ringwald had cut school
to go shopping.
Right.
But it's implied. And I had even forgotten the fire alarm thing. Bender's there every Saturday.
Yes.
I also really like the wrestler's monologue, in that it takes it from one extreme to the next. That at first glance, what he did was funny and rambunctious. Maybe it's not handled very subtly, but My wife responded that the jocks that she knew in high school weren't that introspective,
right,
to get to the point where he realizes how humiliating it was.
Sure.
But I really like the arc of that, how it goes from one extreme to the next, almost like Anthony Michael Hall in reverse.
Yeah, I think just by the time he gets to shouting, "Win, damn it, win," I feel like it's a little on the nose. But again, this is not like a really subtle movie at all.
No, my favorite example of something that's not subtle,
there's a lot of it,
is Anthony Michael Hall's mother. You find a way to study.
Yeah.
And for some reason,
his dad, but did you notice his dad at the end?
That's John Hughes.
Yeah.
That Anthony Michael Hall's sister is allowed to be a little snot, but he's not studying enough.
Right, right.
It's weird.
So originally, there's two stories about the casting of the film. One says that Hughes wrote the part of Claire for Molly Ringwald to allow her to do something different, because in 16 Candles, she was more the Ally Sheedy part, even though I don't quite agree with that, but that's the story that comes down. But she wanted to play Claire because it was something different. And then the other story is that Ally Sheedy was okay. He wrote the part of Allison, and Molly Ringwald's going to play Allison.
That's what I had heard.
And then she said, "No, I want to play Claire because it's different." Okay, so that's one story. Ally Sheedy says no, that she was always going to be Allison because she had gone into audition for 16 Candles. And when she went into audition for 16 Candles, she had recently been in an accident and had two black eyes. And that image stuck with Hughes to such a degree that when it came time to cast sort of this goth girl mm-hmm. for Breakfast Club, he thought of her and cast her. So there's a possible reality in which those two parts are switched. I have an impossible time thinking of Molly Ringwald playing the Allison part.
As do I, because maybe I'm not remembering 16 Candles very well, but 16 Candles to Claire in Breakfast Club doesn't seem to be a stretch to me.
Not as much as I think. You know, 16 Candles, she's kind of a wallflower. She's ignored, but she's not a misfit. You know what
no,
I mean?
No.
She's just like not one of the popular girls. She's just this girl that walks around. Yeah, to me, it's like a no-brainer. So I find it odd that there was ever a chance that she was going to play Allison. But supposedly that's the story that goes around. I don't know. So you have a lot of positive things to say about The Breakfast Club. Are you still ambivalent about it?
I am. I think, like, there's a critical faculty inside of my head that won't let me love it as much as I want to love it. I'll give you one final example. The lunch scene. Really on the nose, almost from a screenwriting textbook.
Yeah.
Perhaps the characters can reveal something about themselves yes. by what they choose to eat.
Again, it goes back to their costuming and their person. You're this, and you're this, and you're this, and you're this, and yeah, the
but
lunch
uses
is really...
choices are really great, and the scene where Ringwald is being so persnickety about the bento box, and
right.
here's what you do, and the fact that Bender doesn't have a lunch,
yes.
and then he's... I always thought, every time I've seen it, is that when Bender sits down, he's going to eat Anthony Michael Hall's lunch. Coffee? Soup. and the wonder of what an athlete eats, and of course, Ally Sheedy's wonderful Captain Crunch sandwich, that what in lesser hands could have been a screenwriting exercise,
yeah.
I think is redeemed by the very specificity of it.
Okay. I could see that.
Or like... just the way Anthony Michael Hall says, soup.
Soup is great. And I do like how long he lets the Emilio Estevez joke go on, because there's a point where he stops. And in the reality of the film, that makes no sense, because it's not as though he couldn't see the bottom of the bag to know that there was still food in it. You know, if you apply that logic,
but
it doesn't work.
There is a pause.
There's a pause where you think he's done, and then he reaches back into the bag and continues to pull food out, which is funny. But I will say I've never liked the pimento loaf on the statue joke.
From the very first time I saw it, and maybe this is just that I've had a diet of lesser films.
You keep waiting for it to come back?
Yeah, you keep waiting for it to
right.
pay off.
It's the Chekhov's pimento loaf.
I love the ugly statue in the library, though. Next weekend, I'm looking forward to Beetlefest, which I attend every year. And in the hotel, that hosts Beetlefest, there is a much larger version of the library statue.
Nice.
From Breakfast Club.
Are you going to sit on it and headbang Bender style?
A lot of people, I've actually heard this in a hotel, tell their friends we'll meet at the ugly statue. But a couple years ago, they did a big remodel. Like, they closed the damn hotel for 3 months and remodeled it. And then everyone came back for Beetlefest, and everything was different except they kept the statue.
Nice.
I think it was either so expensive or so heavy they couldn't move it. In any case, I'm getting off topic. Ultimately, what do you think of the Breakfast Club?
I still am a fan. I think it works, you know, even if... I think there's some universality to it. I think it's, you know, kind of dated, and even the types of kids that it is positing don't exist in the same form anymore, although I think there are variations enough that it still holds up and it's still kind of universal. So I like it as both kind of an artifact and as a film that exists out of time in this way of trying to comment on the experience of being a teenager and acknowledging, like, hey, it's not just about trying to get laid or like get beer into the house when our parents leave. Like, it can be difficult. And I always say, and this is not profound, but sometimes people will complain about their day or something, and then they'll say, like, oh, I'm sorry, I know you have this thing going on that's way worse or whatever. And I've always said, like, yeah, but everyone's problems are real to them, you know. And I think this is a good example of that, that I think as adults we can stand back and be like, well, you're going to get through it. Being a teenager sucks, and what you're dealing with actually isn't all that uncommon. But here's a movie that acknowledges that when you are 16, this seems like the biggest deal in the world.
It's monolithic. It's
right.
It's operatic. As a teacher, I really, really like the scene between Vern and the janitor where Vern is expressing the fact that the kids have changed.
Yeah.
Because I think that happens in everyone's career, and I think you have to be smart enough to know, and Capolos pegs it, by and large, the kids don't change.
Right.
It's you that changes.
Right.
That during your career, if the kids like you at all, you go from being brother to uncle to father to uncle to grandfather to I don't want to have anything to do with you.
Right.
And that's the way of things.
Yeah.
But it's Wes Craven talks about that in one of those horror documentaries, that older people are always shaking their heads and wondering what's going on with the younger generation. Nothing is going on with the younger generation. You're getting older. Deal with it.
I have this all the time with music nowadays, where I hear music and I'm just like, I don't get it. This is not good. And then I'm like, oh, my parents thought that about my music, and their parents thought that about their music.
And I would argue you're not supposed to get it, because literally when I was back in high school, I loved music and listened to a broad range of music and literally was so self-aware that I wondered to myself frequently, what could my kids possibly listen to that I wouldn't like?
Yeah. They
and
found
then,
it.
And then we had and then we have rap.
They found it. I didn't ever want to be the person who was like, what is this? How does anyone like this? Yeah.
Because there's people who like it.
I know, but it's and I'm not talking about just rap. I'm talking about a specific it's anyway.
Yes. Much better to play Simple Minds or that song that they all dance to in the library.
And Simple Minds, here's one of those examples where Simple Minds, like, that's become one of my favorite songs of all time. Now, that has to be because I tie it in to my feelings about the movie. On its own, that's not one of the best songs ever written, and yet it's so anthemic. And when I think of it, I can't help but feel like John Bender at the end of the movie pumping his fist into the air.
And that was a big hit in 1985. Yeah. Man, you heard that everywhere.
And I love the idea that his last line before his triumphant fist pump into the air is, I'll see you next Saturday. Like, his life hasn't actually changed, and yet in a way it has. You know, it's he's still going back to detention in a week. I don't know. I think the movie gets a lot of small things right inside of trying to get too many big things right. You know what I mean? That the
That's
big
a good
things,
way to put it.
The big things are like, all right, take it easy, John Hughes.
But I think it's ultimately the smaller things that redeem it.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's possible? And you would be kind of the test case, because I know you saw it in 85, but then probably haven't seen it since. Do you think it's possible to, you said, you know, I don't love it. Do you think it's possible to see the movie for the first time as an adult and love it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if it still speaks to young people. And before school let out in June, I had mentioned to several classes that the August film was going to be The Breakfast Club, introduced by you. And the reactions of some of them showed me that this film is very beloved.
Yeah, in that's their fascinating. Eyes.
And I'm hoping that translates to a lot of people there last. Oh, there, wait a minute. There was a lot of people there last night. It'll be interesting to see who shows up. I will say this, because both of us see a lot of movies. It's really entertaining.
Yeah.
It's never not entertaining.
Right. And the cast is as good as I think most of them ever were during kind of the 80s Brat Pack years, because you consider that this same year St. Elmo's Fire came out and they're playing post-collegiate.
That was the same year?
Same year.
Because one of the things,
and they're awful.
One of the things I wrote when I was, well, it's because Anthony Michael Hall's not in it. One of the things I wrote last night was, well, this is better than St. Elmo's Fire.
St. Elmo's Fire is such a weird thing, because if it comes on TV, I'm almost compelled to
watch it. Oh, yeah.
It's not good.
No.
It's not a good
movie. No way.
No.
My favorite is, and by that I mean least favorite, is Rob Lowe's speech to the comatose Demi Moore, where he explains the title and says, hey, it's our time. Or like, it's our time on the edge or something, because these characters are so self-aware.
My favorite is Andrew McCarthy, because the same way I identify with Anthony Michael Hall in Breakfast Club, I identify with Andrew McCarthy in St. Elmo's Fire. Like, I would be the Andrew McCarthy. I'd be the guy who wants to be a writer, who's pining away for the girl he can't have. And then we get to the scene where he puts on sunglasses and a fedora and sings Respect in his apartment. Because that's something that's never been done in a movie before.
No, the nadir of that for me in St. Elmo's Fire is he's working on obituaries, which is interesting because he used to work for Legacy. And he has this dream to publish a column full of great thoughts. And when he finally does, he like slaps it on a windshield or something. And if you freeze the frame, you can read it. It's awful. It's like disconnected, random, shitty thoughts.
He's a genius. Ooh, we know St. Elmo's Fire.
No one ever thought of doing that before.
We know that movie way too well, apparently.
And that movie even had that Man in Motion song
to
have the same trope as Breakfast Club. I cannot believe those came out in the same year.
Same year. And Judd Nelson and Ali Sheedy and Emilio Estevez are all in both, and in one are playing high school students, and in the other have just graduated from college.
Wow.
And St. Elmo's Fire is a garbage movie. The last thing I will say is that for as much as John Hughes is remembered as a filmmaker, to the point where now, you know, there's all these movies that come out and that it's like a touchstone that we point to. Well, it's kind of like John Hughes. We want to do the guys writing this new Spider-Man, the third reboot in a decade, are saying, we're going to do it like a John Hughes movie. And we all kind of know what that means, which is just like, we're going to tell it about teenagers and take it very seriously. Even though he only did that in a handful of movies, because a lot of his other movies are big, dumb, broad comedies, you know, or The Great Outdoors, which we just talked about, I think, the last time you were on, right? So he's written some good stuff. But he's not like a great filmmaker. This is essentially a play that he's filmed.
And that's another thought I had last night, that except for the language, which many high school theater directors have no problem violating their contract on plays that they're paying royalties on, and there's part of the contract where you can't change the play, but a lot of high school theater directors throw that right over their shoulder.
To remove swears or add more?
Believe it or not.
Tell me about the fucking rabbits, George.
So, I'm watching and I'm like, I don't understand why this isn't done at every high school.
Yeah.
It's one set. It would be really easy to do.
Yeah.
And in the style of some of our least favorite high school theater directors, just have the kids do the movie.
Well, right. That's immediately what would happen. You would have the kid doing the Judd Nelson impression, which, can you imagine how insufferable that would be?
In fact, I was watching it, and if you were to do it as a play, you don't need the dropping off scene. It opens
right.
with them entering the right. library one by one.
Right.
The dance scene works. I mean, everything works. You could do it. Could it be that it hasn't been licensed, that they won't allow you to
do it? I'm sure.
Because that would be really popular.
No, I'm sure. And I don't know, you know, what John Hughes' wishes were in his will or whatever, but I know he was very protective of his work, maybe this movie more than any.
And look at it from a nuts and bolts logistical perspective. You're in a high school. Gee, do you think you can get those desks and those chairs and those shelves on right. the stage for one weekend?
Right.
That'd be the easiest set that the tech director had ever built.
Somebody's going to do it after hearing this podcast.
Send 20 kids down to the library and just have them grab a bunch of shit.
What they'll end up doing is writing songs to go with it and then turning it into a musical, because that became very popular to turn movies into musicals that shouldn't be musicals.
Breakfast Club, the Broadway musical.
Right.
And I'm looking forward to that, because at one point, Bender has this big showstopper, and the song is called This Is What You Get in My House for yeah. Spilling Paint in the Garage.
The song is actually called Smoke Up Johnny. And
that's catchy.
Can you imagine it? I actually can. I remember seeing the musical version of Footloose one time.
Oh, yeah.
Not as bad as the big musical, but Footloose is really terrible, and you would just sit there and say, like, oh, here's a terrible song they wrote for the show. Here's a terrible song they wrote for the show. Oh, wait, Holding Out for a Hero. Here's another terrible song.
Yeah,
they wrote. Every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, let's hear it for the boy. Okay, great. Nope, bad songs written for the show.
I've never seen it. I've seen the soundtrack album back when Tower Records was still a going concern. I guess it didn't. It, like, played for a couple weeks. They turned My Favorite Year into a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
I would be interested in seeing that, but again, you know what it's going to be.
Right. Yeah. It's just, hey, this takes place backstage somewhere. Let's put it on the stage. Anyway, that's all we're going to say about The Breakfast Club. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook. Follow, email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts. You know, J-Bones, I really hope that you've thought about what it is that you did to get here today and that you won't do it again.
I'll see you next Saturday.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.